Fortunately, as you will have deduced from the existence of this program, I escaped this unhappy fate and managed to haul myself back onto the pontoon. I took a seat on a deck chair in the mild sunshine and toweled off with Alan's shirt. Then I pulled out the newspaper files Alan Howe had given me on the American couple who had died out there. I had read them once before, but now that I could attach visible landmarks to the words, I went through them again with particular interest. The story, insofar as the known events are concerned, is straightforward. In January 1998, Thomas and Eileen Lonergan of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who had recently completed a tour of duty as Peace Corps volunteers in the South Pacific, were vacationing in Australia before returning home when they went for a day's scuba diving on the reef with a company called Outer Edge. At the end of the afternoon, they failed to return to the dive boat at the time directed. The dive crew failed to note their absence and left without them. 2.5 days passed before anyone reported them missing. No trace of them was ever found. Why the Lonergans didn't return to the dive boat, and what became of them when they realized they had been stranded, are necessarily matters of conjecture. From where I sat, I could see the scuba diving boat, which a passing crew member informed me was about 3 nautical miles away. A nautical mile is about 100 yards longer than a land mile. It looked awfully small and distant, but the Lonergans, who were experienced divers and at home in the water, should have found the swim no terrible hardship. Conditions were perfect. The sea was calm, the water temperature was 29 degrees centigrade, 84 degrees Fahrenheit, and they had on wetsuits. In addition to the pontoon, they had the somewhat easier option of swimming to St. Crispin Reef, just 1.2 nautical miles away, where there were some exposed coral outcrops onto which they could clamber to await rescue. The problem, as Alan Howe had so rightly recalled, was that to reach either of these refuges meant crossing a deep-water trench known to be a haunt of large pelagians, which is to say toothy sharks, and the occasional blundering grouper. From this point, the mystery deepened. A few days after their disappearance, the Lonergan's flotation jackets washed up undamaged on a mainland beach. Why two people stranded at sea would take off their flotation devices would appear to be an unanswerable question. Moreover, the absence of damage to the flotation jackets suggested that they had not been attacked by sharks. Puzzlement grew further when police examined the belongings they had left behind at the backpackers' hostel in Cairns, where they had been staying. There it became clear that the polite young American couple weren't as happy as they appeared to be. Eileen Lonergan had recorded in her diary that her husband had been depressed and said he wanted to end it all on a scuba diving trip. Whoa. He had suggested that he would take her with him. Double woe. There was obviously more to this than met the eye. Alan emerged at last, looking invigorated and holding in his stomach in a manner that recalled Jeff Chandler in some of his later films, chattering with tedious gusto about what a brilliant experience it had been and what an egregious wimp I was. He slipped on his shirt and fell into the chair beside me, looking very happy. Then he sat up and patted himself extravagantly. "This shirt's wet," he announced. "Is it?" I said, frowning with concern. "It's wringing wet." I touched it lightly. "Why, yes, it is," I agreed. They were losing people all over the place in Queensland these days, it appeared. The papers the next day were full of reports of an inquest that had been convened to examine the disappearance of a young British backpacker named Daniel Newt on the Cape Tribulation Promontory almost 2 years earlier. Newt had set off alone on a 6-hour hike to a place called Mount Sorrow and had dutifully filled out the safety forms bush hikers are asked to complete to help searchers in the event that they fail to return. Unfortunately, no one from the National Park staff collected or checked the safety sheets that day. In fact, it turned out that no one from the National Park staff ever collected or checked the safety sheets. So when Newt failed to return, no one noticed, and no alarm call went out. Even more puzzling was that although Newt had left a tent pitched on the grounds of a backpacker's lodge in Daintree, the staff at the lodge did not notify the authorities that he was missing for 23 days. An employee at the lodge told the inquest that it was common for people to abandon their tents and leave without telling management. But of course. The upshot is that by the time a search was organized, almost a month had passed. Newt's body has never been found. All this took on a certain relevance the next morning when Alan and I drove into Cairns to run a couple of errands. Something in the window of a sportswear shop caught his eye, so we went in. While he was off trying on items of clothing, I chatted pleasantly with the two middle-aged women who work there. I mentioned for no reason, just making conversation, really, that Cairns had been much in the news lately. "Oh," said one of the women, a little coolly. "You know, the Lonergan case and the Chinese boat people and this poor kid who went missing at Daintree." "Oh, all that," said the lady with a dismissive air. "They always blow these things out of proportion down south." Her colleague nodded vigorously. "Whenever there's a chance to make Queensland look bad, they leap on it. It was just the same with the cyclone. I was in Sydney that week visiting my sister, and you know they had pages of articles about it." "Well, it was a big story," I pointed out. "But they wouldn't have covered it like that if it had been in Western Australia." "Oh?" I said. "No, they do it to discourage people from coming up here, you see." "You really think so?" "Oh, yes. They don't want visitors to leave Sydney. They want to keep them down there. So they take any story that makes Queensland look, you know, dangerous or backward, and they twist the facts about to frighten people." They both nodded in the sincerest agreement. "It was the same with that young couple out on the reef. It's quite evident that it was suicide, but they blew it all out of proportion." "All out of proportion," seconded her friend, "so that they could make it look like it wasn't safe to go out on the reef." "And the boy at Daintree?" I ventured. "They don't know that he's dead at all," she said in the tone of one who has unimpeachable sources. "But he's been missing for 2 years." "Yes, but he's been sighted all over the Cape York Peninsula." "All over," agreed her friend. "I'm sorry, are you saying the papers falsely reported his death to make Queensland look dangerous?" "I'm just saying that all the facts aren't in." She nodded primly and crossed her arms. Her partner did likewise. And I thought, madder than cut snakes. As it happened, we were heading to Daintree ourselves. It was as far north as you could get on a paved road in this part of Australia, so we decided to go and have a look. By mid-morning, all traces of rain had abated, and the sun began to come out, tentatively at first, but then with sumptuous gusto. Queensland was transformed. Suddenly we were in Hawaii, tropical mountains running down to sparkling seas, sweeping bays, flawless beaches guarded by listing palms, little green and rocky islands standing off the headlands. From time to time we drove through sunny cane fields, overlooked by the steep blue eminence of the Great Dividing Range. At Daintree we parked and got out to have a look around. We walked down to the edge of the Daintree River, where both the road and Barrel Rock came to their respective abrupt terminations. We couldn't see any sign of crocodiles. Then we got back in the car and drove off down a winding side road that leads to a ferry across the Daintree to Cape Tribulation. The ferry had been shut for a week by the rains, so there wasn't much point in going down there, but I wanted to see the Cape at least from across the river, and there was the off chance that we might glimpse a crocodile. To our surprise, the ferry was operating. We had been assured in Daintree that it was still shut. "Reopened yesterday," said the ferryman, a man of few words. So we took the ferry across and set off on the 20-mile drive to Cape Tribulation through Daintree National Park. The road wound up and through a mountainous and intensely beautiful rainforest. We had at last made it into the wet tropics, and I couldn't have been more pleased. The Daintree Forest is a remnant of a time when the world was a single landmass, the whole covered in steamy growth. As time passed, continents split up and drifted off to the far corners of the globe, but the Daintree, through some tectonic fluke, escaped the more dramatic changes of climate and orientation that spurred ecological change elsewhere. In consequence, there are plants out there, whole families of plants, that survive as nowhere else. In 1972, scientists began to appreciate just how ancient and exceptional Australia's northern rainforest is when some cattle mysteriously sickened and died after grazing in the jungle's lower slopes. The cows, it turned out, had been poisoned by the seeds of a tree called Idiospermum australiensis. What was unexpected about this was that Idiospermum was thought to have vanished from the Earth 100 million years ago. In fact, it was doing very well in the Dane Tree, as were 11 other members of its family, a primitive outpost of botany called the angiosperms, from which all flowering plants are descended. That's the kind of place Dane Tree National Park is, dark, dense, seeming to belong to some remote epoch. It's a landscape in which it wouldn't entirely surprise you to see pterosaurs gliding through the trees or velociraptors sprinting across the road ahead. In fact, there is quite a lot of odd life out there. This is one of the few remaining areas where you can hope to see cassowaries. They look much like emus, except that they have a bony growth on their head called a casque, and the infamous murderous claw on each foot. They attack by jumping up and striking out with both feet together. Fortunately, this doesn't happen very often. The last fatal attack was in 1926, when a cassowary charged a 16-year-old boy who had been taunting it and sliced open his jugular vein as it bounded across him. The reason attacks are so few is that cassowaries are exceedingly reclusive and now, alas, very few in number. No more than 1,000 of them survive. The Dane Tree is also one of the last homes of the celebrated tree kangaroo, which, as its name suggests, is a kangaroo that lives in trees. But it is even shyer than the cassowary and almost never seen. So dense is the jungle, and so remote from the centers of academia, that much of it remains unstudied. The first scientific study of cassowaries, for instance, was only begun about a decade ago. At length, the road ended at a sunny clearing in the jungle with, incongruously, a takeout food stand and a phone booth. Tucked away in the extravagant foliage was a campground, and beside it an arrowed sign pointed the way to the beach. This led to a boardwalk through mangroves. Little creatures plinked unseen into the swampy water as we approached. After a few minutes, we emerged onto the beach. It was remarkably beautiful. A great sweep of soft white sand strewn with driftwood, palm fronds, and other natural clutter, standing before a very bright blue bay. Ahead of us loomed a towering headland, cloaked in green. The spot was sunnily pristine, exactly as it must have appeared to James Cook when he first laid eyes on it more than 2 centuries ago. He called it Cape Tribulation, because it was here that the Endeavour disastrously lodged on coral, some 12 miles off the coast. Severely holed, it was in imminent danger of sinking, but Cook had with him a seaman who had once been in similar straits on a ship that had been saved by an unusual process known as fathering, in effect bandaging the underside of the ship by running a sail underneath it and pulling tight to cover the hole. It was a desperate and improbable measure, but miraculously it worked. Cook nursed the ship to shore a few miles around the headland from where we were now. The crew spent 7 weeks making repairs before sailing off to England and glory. Had the Endeavour sunk and Cook failed to get home, history would, of course, have been very different. Australia would very likely have become French, an eerie thought to say the least, and Britain would have had to adjust its colonial ambitions accordingly. No part of the world would have escaped the effects. Melbourne might now stand on African plains. Sydney could be the capital of the Royal Colony of California. Who can possibly say? What is certain is that the global balance of power would have changed in ways beyond imagining. On the other hand, we would almost certainly have been spared the Bee Gees, so it's not as if it would have been an unmitigated disaster. Alan and I explored along the beach for half an hour or so, then walked back to the clearing where the food stand was, and had a look at where the road continued on to Cooktown. Beyond the food stand, it became at once a rough and rocky track, which climbed steeply up into the lush hills. It looked like something Harrison Ford would struggle to negotiate in an adventure movie. I had learned only the day before that the track is dangerously and unnervingly tippy, even in good weather, so perhaps it was as well that Alan and I hadn't been let loose on it. In any case, it was impassable now. Still, it did look awfully inviting in an adventuresome sort of way. Cooktown, a former gold mining town that once had a population of 30,000 and has just 200 now, lay 75 kilometers away on the other side of the mountains. It is the last town in eastern Australia. Beyond it, there is nothing but a scattering of Aboriginal settlements along the 600-kilometre track to Cape York, Australia's northernmost point. But this was as far as I was going to get here. I turned around to discover that Alan had slipped off. He reappeared after a minute from the direction of the food stand, bearing two cans of Coke, one of which he passed to me. They didn't have urine, he said, and we both had a good laugh over that. Chapter 15. And so to the top end. We bounced into Darwin through the outer strands of two minor cyclones that were bumping along the north coast, and acquired another rental car, a sleek and powerful Toyota sedan that looked as if it could cover the 1,500 kilometers to Alice Springs in a single rocket-like burst. We dubbed it the Testosterone. The Northern Territory has always had something of a frontier mentality. In late 1998, the inhabitants were invited to become Australia's seventh state, and roundly rejected the notion in a referendum. It appears they quite like being outsiders. In consequence, an area of 523,000 square miles, or about one-fifth of the country, is in Australia but not entirely of it. This throws up some interesting anomalies. All Australians are required by law to vote in federal elections, including residents of the Northern Territory. However, since the Northern Territory is not a state, it has no seats in Parliament. So the Territorians elect representatives who go to Canberra and attend sessions of Parliament, at least that's what they say in their letters home, but don't actually vote or take part or have any consequence at all. Even more interestingly, during national referendums, the citizens of the Northern Territory are also required to vote, but the votes don't actually count toward anything. They're just put in a drawer or something. Seems a little odd to me, but then, as I say, the people seem content with the arrangement. Personally, I feel that the Territorians should not be permitted to take full part in national affairs until they get friendlier hotel staff in Darwin. This might seem a curious basis on which to found a political philosophy, but there you are. Darwin's hoteliers are seriously deficient in the charm department, and if it takes the withholding of certain civil liberties to get them to address the problem, then I think that is a small charge to exact, frankly. Our troubles began when we went looking for our hotel. We were booked into a place called the All Seasons Frontier Hotel, but no such establishment appeared to exist. The guidebook mentioned a top-end frontier hotel, and a tourist leaflet I acquired at the airport listed a Darwin City Frontier Hotel, and yet another listed an all-seasons premier Darwin Central Hotel. All of these we spied, distantly, as we drove around for the next 40 minutes, squabbling quietly in the manner of a fractious married couple. We stopped about half a dozen pedestrians, but none had heard of an all-seasons frontier hotel, except one man who thought it was at Kakadu, 200 kilometers to the east. With the aid of a small, inadequate map, I directed Alan down a series of streets, which proved always to end at a pedestrianized zone or a cul-de-sac of loading bays, to his increasing exasperation. "Can you not read a simple map?" he asked in the peevish tone of a man whose happy hour needs are going unmet, reversing into cardboard boxes and wheelie bins. "No," I replied in kind, "I cannot read a simple map. I can read a good map. This map, however, is useless, less than useless. It is the print equivalent of your driving, if I may say so." Eventually, we stopped outside a large hotel on the seafront, and Alan ordered me to go inside and seek professional guidance. At the front desk, a young man who had evidently invested a recent paycheck in a very large tub of hair gel stood with his back to me, regaling two female colleagues with some droll anecdote. I waited a long minute, then went, "Ahem." He turned his head to give me a look that said, without warmth, "What?" "Could you point me to the All Seasons Frontier Hotel?" I asked politely. Without preamble, he reeled off a series of complex directions. Darwin is full of strange street names: Cavanaugh, Ewan, Fulsh, Nucky, and I couldn't begin to follow. On the counter was a pad of maps, and I asked him if he could show me on that. "It's too far to walk," he said dismissively, and just a bit oddly. I don't want to walk. I've got a car. Then ask your driver to take you. He rolled his eyes for the benefit of the girls, then continued with his story. How I longed for a small firearm, or perhaps a set of industrial tongs with which to clamp his reedy neck and draw his head close to me, the better to hear what I next had to say. It was, "Do you think if I had a driver, I would be asking directions of you? It's a rental car, you snide, irksome, preposterously glossy little shit." I may not have said the words precisely in that order, or indeed at all, but that was certainly the emotional gist of it. With sullen gaze and a long sigh, he took a pen and rapidly but vaguely sketched the route on the map, tore it from the pad, and handed it over as if giving me a voucher to which I had no right. 10 minutes later we pulled up outside a hotel that announced itself, in large letters, as the Darwin City Frontier Hotel. We had passed it several times already, but I had confidently rejected it on each occasion. I stalked through the front doors. "Is this the All Seasons Frontier Hotel?" I barked from an unsocial distance. The young woman behind the counter looked up and blinked. "Yes," she said. "Then," I came much closer, "why don't you put up a sign saying so?" She regarded me lovely. "It says it on the side of the building." "Well, it doesn't," I said. She favored me with a thin, knowing, supremely condescending smile. "Yes, it does." "Well, it doesn't." Torn between her training in customer relations and her youthful certitude, she hesitated, and in a soft voice said, "Does." I held up a finger in a way that said, "Don't move, don't go anywhere. I'm going to check this out and then come back and throttle someone. You, actually." I went out and ranged around the building in the manner of a demented building inspector, examining it from every angle and from various distances, held up a silencing finger to Alan, who watched bewildered from the driver's seat, then came back in and announced, "It doesn't say All Seasons on it anywhere." She looked at me and said nothing, but I could see she was thinking, "Does." I am happy to let the record show that by whatever name it goes, the Darwin City Frontier Hotel was a wondrously inept and disappointing establishment. It was overpriced, charmless, and inconveniently sited. The TV in my room didn't work, the pillows were concrete slabs, and the receptionist was irritating. This was not the Australia I had come to respect and adore. To get to the hotel bar, we discovered after much blind experimentation and a further interview with our young friend at the front desk, it was necessary to descend by a back stairway to the basement, find our way through some storage areas, leave the building, and present ourselves at a pair of automatic sliding doors, which weren't working. Alan, who is not a man to let any impediment stand between him and his evening beverage, yanked them open with a vehemence that was impressive, and we squeezed through. The bar was liberally, not to say unexpectedly, arrayed with rough, boisterously drunk, and dangerous-looking fellows, all with copious tattoos, long hair, and beards like mattress-ticking. Not exactly the patrons you would expect to find drinking in the bar of a business hotel. "Like a fucking ZZ Top convention," Alan muttered darkly but correctly. We procured a couple of beers and sat primly in a corner, like two old maids at an inner-city bus station, and watched as two of the burlier of the fellows played a game of pool in which each disappointing shot, and there seemed to be almost no other kind, was accompanied by a whack of cue across something metallic or unyielding. The pool table, a chair back, the swinging light above the table. It seemed only a matter of time before flesh and bone came into the equation. We decided to repair to the rooftop restaurant on the 7th floor, in search of a more serene and composed environment. The restaurant was a large room with big windows giving expansive views over Darwin by twilight. Of the perhaps 50 tables in the room, no more than 3 or 4 were occupied. So it came as a surprise when the hostess informed us, with a look of stark panic, that no tables were available at the moment. "But it's practically empty," I pointed out. "I'm sorry, but we've got a terrible rush on." As if to underline the urgency of the situation, she flew off. We took a seat at the bar and had 2 more beers, which we coaxed out of a cheerful Indonesian fellow who sometimes wandered past, and may actually have been an employee. After another 30 minutes and further inquiries, we were finally granted a table by a far window. There we sat for 10 minutes more, until a waitress came out and plonked in front of each of us a small standard terracotta flower pot in which had been baked a little loaf of bread. "What's this?" I asked. "It's bread," she replied. "But it's in a flower pot." She gave me a look that I was beginning to think of as the Darwin stare. It was a look that said, "Yeah, so?" "Well, isn't that kind of unusual?" I said. She considered for a moment. "Is a bit, I suppose. And will we be following a horticultural theme throughout the meal?" Her expression contorted in a deeply pained look, as if she were trying to suck her face into the back of her head. "What? Will the main course arrive in a wheelbarrow?" I elaborated helpfully. "Will you be serving the salad with a pitchfork?" "Oh, no, it's just the bread that's special. I'm so pleased to hear it." Before we could take our relationship to the next stage and ask for drinks or perhaps a menu, she was gone, announcing as she went that she would be back when she could, but that there was a bit of a rush on. There then followed the most extraordinary evening in which, each time we hankered for food or additional refreshment or just the sound of an Australian voice, we had to go off and stand by the kitchen doors until we caught someone emerging. Some of the other few diners were doing likewise. During one foray, I asked a man with an empty beer glass if he dined here often. "Wife likes the view," he explained, and we looked across the room to a plump little woman who gave us a small but cheery wave. "Service is a bit slow, don't you think?" "Bloody hopeless," he agreed. "They've got some kind of rush on, apparently." In the morning, a new man was behind the front desk. "And how did you enjoy your stay, sir?" he asked smoothly. "It was singularly execrable," I replied. "Oh, excellent," he purred, taking my card. "In fact, I would go so far as to say that the principal value of a stay in this establishment is that it is bound to make all subsequent service-related experiences seem, in comparison, refreshing." He made a deeply appreciative expression, as if to say, "Praise indeed," and presented my bill for signature. "Well, we hope you'll come again." "I would sooner have bowel surgery in the woods with a stick," I said. His expression wavered, then held there for a long moment. "Excellent," he said again, but without a great show of conviction. We went into town to look around. Darwin is in the steamy heart of the tropics, which to my mind imposes certain stylistic requirements. White buildings with verandas, louvered windows, potted palms, lazy ceiling fans, cool drinks in tall glasses presented by obsequious houseboys, men in white suits and Panama hats, women in floral print cotton dresses, a little mahjong to pass the sultry afternoons, Sydney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre in evidence somewhere, looking hot and shifty. Anything that falls short of these simple ideals will always leave me disappointed, and Darwin failed in every respect. To be fair, the place has been knocked about a good deal. It was bombed repeatedly by the Japanese in World War II, and then devastated by Cyclone Tracy in 1974, so much of it is necessarily new. Even so, there was almost nothing to suggest a particular climatic affiliation. We could have been in Wollongong or Bendigo or any other moderately prosperous provincial city. The one small local peculiarity was that there seemed to be no one about of professional demeanor. Nearly every person on the streets was bearded and tattooed and scuffed along with a wino shuffle, as if some very large mission had just turned everyone out for the day. Here and there, too, were scatterings of Aborigines, shadowy and furtive, sitting quietly on the margins of sunny plazas, as if in a waiting room. While Alan went off to get some money out of a bank machine, I drifted into the vicinity of three Aboriginal people, two men and a woman, all staring at nothing. I gave them a nod and respectful good day smile as I passed, but failed signally to establish eye contact. It was as if they were somewhere else, or I was transparent. We had breakfast in a small Italian cafe, the only customers, then drove out to the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory, because I had read that it had a box jellyfish on display. I had expected the museum to be small and dusty, and to detain us for no longer than it took to find and briefly examine the jellyfish, but in fact it was sleek and modern and quite wonderful. It was improbably large for a provincial museum and chock-full of interesting stuff thoughtfully presented. One area was devoted to Cyclone Tracy, still the most devastating natural event in Australian history. It all but blew away the town on Christmas Eve 1974. According to a recorded commentary, most people didn't expect the storm to come to much. A weaker cyclone had passed through a few weeks earlier without doing significant damage, and the leading edge of Tracy brushed over the town without leaving any hint of particular ferocity to come. Most people turned in as if it were a normal night. It wasn't until Darwin was hit by the back end of the storm system, about 2:30 a.m., that people realized they were really in for it. As the winds whipped up to 160 miles an hour, Darwin's frail tropical houses began to shed pieces and then to disintegrate. Most of the housing was post-war fiberboard homes of a type called the D series, which were cheap and quick to build, but could not stand up to a real hurricane. Before the night was out, Tracy had blown away 9,000 homes and killed more than 60 people. Just off the main display area was a small darkened chamber in which you could listen to a tape recording of the storm that had been made on the night by a Roman Catholic priest. A sign on the door warned that people who had lived through the storm might find the recording distressing, which I thought perhaps a trifle overwrought until I heard it myself. Well, it was an amazingly effective way of making you realize how powerful and terrifying such a storm can be. The recording began with various lively but clearly preliminary wind noises, branches knocking, gates banging, and then rose and rose again till it was a continuous howling unearthly fury, with sounds of metal roofs being wrenched from their moorings and other weighty debris flying murderously through the night. Experiencing it in pitch darkness, as the locals would have done, gave it an immediacy that was inexpressibly effective. I actually found myself ducking whenever anything crashed nearby. When it finished, Alan and I exchanged impressed and drained looks and proceeded onto the visual part of the display with a new appreciation. On a wall outside, a television endlessly showed the original Australian Broadcasting Corporation footage of what the town woke up to the next day. Namely, total devastation. The film, taken from a slow-moving car, showed street after street in which every structure was flattened. Much of the rest of the museum was given over to cases of stuffed animals, illustrating the Northern Territory's extraordinary biological diversity. Pride of place was given to an enormous stuffed crocodile named Sweetheart, who was, for a time, the most famous in Australia. Sweetheart, who was, despite the effeminate name, a male, had a passionate dislike for outboard engines and used to attack any boats that disturbed his peace. Unusually for a crocodile, he never harmed a person, but he crunched at least 15 boats and their motors, bringing a certain unexpected liveliness to many a fisherman's afternoon. In 1979, when it was feared that he would do himself some serious harm, he was constantly being clobbered by propellers, wildlife officials decided to move him somewhere safer. Unfortunately, the capture was botched when a cable snagged and Sweetheart drowned. So he was stuffed and put on display in the Darwin Museum, where he has been impressing visitors ever since with his very substantial heft. He stretches almost 17 feet and in life weighed more than 1,700 pounds. Another case answered a question that must have occurred to nearly everyone at one time or another. Namely, how exactly do they stuff the animals? I had always assumed they filled them with sawdust or old socks or something. Well, here I learned, by means of a small stuffed animal shown in cross-section, that in fact a mounted specimen is empty but for a spare interior framework of styrofoam balls and wooden dowels. I was touched and grateful that some curator had taken the trouble to provide this insight. Also on display were lots of snakes and reptiles, many of them quite severely murderous, which Alan regarded with particular absorption. Perhaps the most admirable quality about the museum, and I suspect this is a real Northern Territory thing, is that it didn't mince words about the dangers of the world outside. Most museums in Australia are at pains to stress the unlikelihood of anything happening to you. The Darwin Museum makes it quite obvious, with cold facts and figures, that if something does happen to you out there, you are really going to regret it. This was most potently displayed in the aquatic creatures section, and here at last we found what we had come to see, a large glass cylinder containing a preserved box jellyfish, the deadliest creature on Earth. It was remarkably unprepossessing, a translucent box-shaped blob 6 or 8 inches high, with thread-like tentacles several feet long trailing off beneath it. Like all jellyfish, it is all but brainless, but its lethality is unbelievable. The tentacles of a box jellyfish carry enough wallop to kill a roomful of people, yet they live exclusively on tiny krill-like shrimp, creatures that hardly require a great deal of violent subduing. As ever in the curious world of Australian biology, no one knows why the jellyfish evolved such extravagant toxicity. Alongside were displays of other dangerous sea creatures, of which the Northern Territory has an impressive plenitude. 5 types of stingrays, 2 of blue-ringed octopus, 30 varieties of sea snakes, 8 types of cone shells, and the usual roguish assortment of stonefish, scorpionfish, firefish, and others too numerous to list and too depressing to dwell on. All these are found in shallow coastal waters, in rock pools, and even sometimes on the beaches themselves. It is a wonder to me that anyone goes within 100 feet of the sea in northern Australia. The sea snakes are especially unnerving, not because they are aggressive, but because they are inquisitive. Stray into their territory, and they will come to check you out, all but rubbing against you in the manner of cats seeking affection. They are the most sweet-tempered creatures in existence, but cross them, or alarm them, and they can hit you with enough venom to kill 3 grown men. Now that's scary. As we were studying the display, a man, lean and lavishly bearded in the Darwinian style, said good day and asked how we were doing. He identified himself as Dr. Phil Alderslade, curator of Selenterids. Jellyfish and corals, he added at once, seeing our expressions of frank ignorance. I noticed you taking notes, he added further. I told him of my devotion to box jellyfish and asked him if he worked with them himself. Oh, sure, he replied. So how do you keep from getting stung? Basic precautions, really. You wear a wetsuit, of course, and rubber gloves, and you just take a good deal of care when handling them, because if even a tiny piece of tentacle is left on a glove and you accidentally touch it to bare skin, wiping sweat from your face or brushing away a fly or something, you can get a very nasty sting, believe me. Have you ever been stung? Once, he said. My gloves slipped and a tentacle touched me just here. He showed us the soft underside of his wrist. It bore a faint scar about 1/2 inch long. Just touched me, but geez, it bloody hurt. What did it feel like? We asked together. The only thing I can compare it to is if you took a lit cigarette and held it to your skin, held it there a goodish long while, maybe 30 seconds. That's what it felt like. You get stung from time to time by various things in my line, and I can tell you I've never felt anything like it. So what would a couple of yards feel like? I wondered. He shook his head at the thought of it. If you tried to imagine the worst pain possible, it would be beyond that. You're dealing with pain of an order of magnitude well past anything most people have ever experienced. He did something you don't often see a scientist do. He shivered. Then he smiled cheerfully through his extravagant facial hair and excused himself to get back to his corals. We left the museum and headed out of town through Darwin's sunny, orderly suburbs, white bungalows on tidy lawns, and at the edge of town passed a sign that said, Alice Springs, 1,479 kilometers. Ahead, along the lonely Stuart Highway, lay nearly 1,000 miles of largely unrelieved emptiness all the way to Alice Springs. We were on our way into the famous and forbidding Never Never, a land of dangerous heat and bone-white sunshine. The road, the track, as it is still sometimes called, was nearly empty but straight and well-maintained. Ask 10 people in Sydney or Melbourne whether the highway from Darwin to Alice Springs is paved or not, and most will have no idea. In fact, it was paved long before most other outback roads. During World War II, when Northern Australia became a principal staging area for the Pacific Campaign. These days it carries a small but growing number of tourists, a very little local traffic, and lots of road trains, multi-trailered trucks up to 150 feet long, which haul freight between the most distant outposts of Australia. To meet a barreling road train coming at you full throttle on a two-lane highway, on which it desires all of its lane and some of yours, is a reliably invigorating experience. An explosive whoomp as you hit its displaced air, followed at once by a consequent lurch onto the shoulder. Several moments of hypermanic axle action, sufficient to loosen dental fillings and empty your pockets of coins, an enveloping shroud of gritty red dust, and the metallic dinks and savage thumps of flying rocks, some involuntary oral emissions on your part as the dust clears and you spy a large boulder dead ahead, and a sudden miraculous return to tranquility and smoothness as the car regains the pavement entirely of its own volition and continues on its way to Alice Springs. The only time that this part of the world had any life at all was during World War II, when 60 airfields and 35 hospitals were built along the highway between Darwin and Daly Waters, and 100,000 American troops were stationed in the area. The sites are still indicated with historical markers, and a couple of times we pulled off to have a look. When Alan Moorhead passed this way for Rum Jungle, a decade after the war's end, most of the buildings were still standing. Sometimes he came across abandoned planes and stacks of munitions quietly decomposing in the desert. I naturally hoped we would as well, but there was nothing out there now, nothing but stillness and oppressive heat and a sense of being in the midst of a boundless nullity. In every direction, for as far as the eye could see, the earth was covered with spinifex, a brittle grass which grew in clumps so closely packed as to give an appearance of verdure. It looked like land that could support 1,000 head of cattle an acre. In fact, spinifex is useless, the only wholly non-edible grass in the world, apparently. It is also murder to travel through, because its needle-sharp points, tipped in silica, break off when brushed and become embedded in the skin, where they fester into small but horrible sores. Scattered among the spinifex were turpentine bushes and man-sized termite mounds, which stood in the desert like ancient dolmens. And that was it. After about 3 hours, we passed through Catherine, a dusty, inoffensive little community, and the last town worthy of the name for 400 miles. Beyond it, the landscape grew more visibly impoverished, and the traffic thinned out from little to almost none. For much of the way, the highway was simply a taut line connecting impossibly distant horizons, the landscape on either side a monumental emptiness, punctuated by spinifex, low bushes, lunar rocks, and almost nothing else. The sky everywhere was huge and brilliantly blue. We had been driving for perhaps 90 minutes in a largely mindless silence when at last Alan spoke. He said, "How are you off for urine?" "I have all I need, thank you. Why do you ask?" "It's just that I notice we're nearly out of petrol." "Truly?" I leaned over to confirm that Alan could indeed interpret a petrol gauge, if not perhaps quite as frequently as one might wish. "Interesting time to notice, Alan," I observed. "This thing just seems to suck up fuel," he replied, perhaps just a trifle inadequately. "So where are we?" he asked after a moment's further reflection. "We're in the middle of nowhere, Alan." "I mean in relation to the next town." I looked at the map. "In relation to the next town, we are," I looked again just to confirm, "in the middle of nowhere." I did some measurements with my fingers. "We appear to be about 40 kilometers from a dot on the map called Larima." "And do they have petrol there?" he asked. "One sincerely hopes so. And do you think we have enough to get there?" "One sincerely, and if I may just say, bloody well hopes so." We chugged into Larima on the last vapor of gas. It was an all but dead hamlet, but it did have a gas station. While Alan fueled up, I went in and purchased a stock of bottled water and snack foods for future emergencies. We vowed that henceforth we would jointly keep a steady eye on the fuel gauge and not let it dip below the halfway mark. There were even greater stretches of emptiness to come. Still, the very slight brush with crisis buoyed our spirits, and we were in a triumphant frame of mind when in late afternoon we rolled into Daly Waters, our destination for the day. Daly Waters, 370 miles from Darwin, 570 from Alice Springs, was off the Stuart Highway a couple of miles down an unpaved side road and over a small ford, which added to its already palpable sense of remoteness. If you were looking for a classic outback spot, you could not improve upon it. It consisted of a few small houses, a tumble-down and obviously long-closed general store, two gasoline pumps unattached to any particular building beneath a sign saying Outback Servo, and a utilitarian pub with a tin roof. All the rest was heat and dust. We parked outside the pub. It had signs hung all over it. One said, "Established 1893, Australia's oldest licensed public house." Nearby, another said, "Established 1930, Northern Territory's oldest pub." The heat when we stepped from the car was stifling. The temperature must have been pushing 110. A tourist brochure I had picked up in Darwin hinted, without actually saying, that the Daily Waters pub provided accommodation. I certainly hoped so, as we were 230 miles from the next town, with nothing but a scattered and uncertain assortment of roadhouses in between. Anyway, it's dangerous to drive through dusk in the outback. That's when kangaroos come bounding out of the gloaming and into the paths of passing vehicles, to the frequent regret of both. Trucks sweep them aside, but they can make a mess of cars, and sometimes the car's occupants. We stepped into the gloomy interior. Gloomy because the world outside was so painfully bright, and we had been out in it all afternoon. I could hardly see a thing. "Hello?" I said to a face behind the bar that might, for all I could tell, have been a ping-pong paddle. "Do you do rooms?" "Finest rooms in Daily Waters," responded the paddle. "Also the only rooms in Daily Waters." As the form spoke, it transmogrified before my eyes into a cheerfully sweaty, bespectacled, slightly harassed-looking man of late middle years. He was sizing us up with a look that was very slightly askance. "You want two rooms," he said, "or are you bunking up together?" "Two," I said at once. This seemed to please him. He rummaged in a drawer and produced two keys with unmatching tags. "This one's a single," he said, laying a key on my palm, "and this one's got a double bed in it, in case one of yours gets lucky tonight." He bounced his eyebrows in a slightly salacious manner. "And do you think that's likely?" "Hey, miracles happen," he said. The rooms were in a separate block that stood alongside the pub. 10 or so of them ranged on either side of a central corridor. I insisted Alan take the double bed, as he was far more likely to get lucky than I was. "Out here," he gave a hollow laugh. "There's 80 million sheep in the outback, Alan. They can't all be picky." We parted to examine our rooms. Basic was the word that leapt to mind. Mine consisted of an ancient bed, a battered dresser, and a raffia wastebasket. There was no TV or phone, and the illumination consisted of a bare yellow bulb dangling from the ceiling. But the solitary window held an ancient air conditioner, which shook and juddered violently when switched on, but did actually seem to generate a little cool air. The bathroom was at the end of the corridor, and was a touch insalubrious, with rust stains in the sink and a shower that looked actively infectious. I went to visit Alan, who was sitting on his bed, grinning inanely. "Come in," he cried, "come in. I'd offer you something from the minibar, but I don't seem to have one. Pull up a chair." "Oh no, there is no chair." "Well, please make full use of the wastebasket." "It is a little basic," I conceded. "Basic? It's a bloody cell. I'd show you the light, but it's burnt out." "I'm sure we can get a replacement for you," I said. "No, no, no. I think I like it better in full darkness." He pursed his lips. "Is it too early to start drinking?" I looked at my watch. It was only 4:45. "It is a bit," I said. "There's actually something I wanted to see." "An attraction? In Daily Waters? What can it be? Someone getting petrol? The evening sheep shag?" "It's a tree," I said. "A tree? Of course it is. Please lead the way." We went out to the car and drove a couple of miles down a hot dirt track. There, on the edge of a large barren clearing beside the road, stood a sign announcing that we had found our way to the Stuart Tree, commemorating John McDougall Stuart, perhaps the greatest of all Australian explorers. A Scottish soldier of bantamweight dimensions, he barely topped 5 feet, Stuart led 3 epic expeditions through the interior and all but killed himself in the process. The bright light of the outback severely disagreed with his vision, and on at least 2 of his trips he was soon seeing double. not perhaps the most encouraging affliction in someone choosing a route through an uncharted wilderness. So, boys, which of those twin peaks do you think we should head for? I say we go for the one under the left-hand sun. Generally, he would finish the trips effectively blind. On his second expedition, he also became crippled with scurvy, for which he seemed to have a particular susceptibility. His body became a mass of sores that will not heal. The skin, one of his lieutenants noted, hung from the roof of his mouth, his tongue became swollen, and he was incapable of talking. Virtually insensible, he was carried on a stretcher for the last 400 miles, and each day his colleagues lifted him down, expecting to find him dead. Yet within a month of returning to society, he was on his feet again and setting off once more into the punishing void. His final attempt, in 1861 and 62, seemed fated to end in failure as well. His horses were much distressed for want of water, and both men and beasts were tormented by bullwaddy, a treacherous shrub with thorny spikes. But at Daly Waters they found a stream with potable water. It was the moment that saved the venture. The men rested, rewatered, and pushed on. In July 1862, 9 months after setting off from Adelaide, they reached the Timor Sea, and in so doing became the first to find a practical route through the heart of the continent. Within a decade, a telegraph line had been strung from Adelaide to what would eventually become Darwin, putting Australia at last in direct touch with the world. In his delight at finding the stream at Daly Waters, Stuart carved an S into a big gum tree. It was this that we had come to see. The tree, it must be said, was not much, a 15-foot-high chunk of gum tree, lopped of its upper branches and long dead. Every guidebook tells you the S is clearly visible, but we couldn't find it. Still, there was a certain pleasure in being at a famous spot that few Australians visit. As we stood there, a flock of galahs, a noisy pinkish parrot, came and settled on the surrounding trees. It was a scene almost entirely without feature. A barren plain, a fat setting sun, a scattering of ragged gum trees. And yet, in a wholly uncharacteristic way, I was captivated by it. I don't know why, but I loved it out here. We regarded it for quite a time, then Alan turned to me and asked in a respectful voice if we could go for a drink now. "Yes, we can," I said. Daly Waters' fame did not begin and end with the fleeting visit of Stuart and his band. In the 1920s, a rather shadowy couple by the name of Pierce came to Daly Waters and opened a shop with a borrowed £20. Amazingly, they did pretty well. Within a few years, they had a shop, a hotel, a pub, and an aerodrome. Daly Waters became a stop-off point between Brisbane and Darwin on the run to Singapore and on to London in the early days of Qantas and the old Imperial Airways. Lady Mountbatten was among the first overnight guests at the hotel. Goodness knows what she made of the place, though I dare say she was just awfully glad to be on solid ground. In the early days, a commercial flight from London involved, in addition to nerves of steel, 42 refueling stops, up to 5 changes of aircraft, and a train journey through Italy because Mussolini wouldn't allow flights through Italian airspace. It took 12 days. As well as the seasonal monsoons, the flights were subject to dust storms, mechanical failures, navigational confusion, and occasional pot shots from hostile or impish Bedouins. Crashes were not infrequent. The perils of aviation in the period are neatly encapsulated in the experience of Harold C. Brinsmead, the head of Australia's Civil Aviation Department, in the first days of commercial aviation. In 1931, Brinsmead was on a flight to London, partly for business and partly to demonstrate the safety and reliability of modern air passenger services, when his plane crashed on takeoff in Indonesia. No one was seriously hurt, but the plane was a write-off. Not wanting to wait for a replacement aircraft to be flown in, Brinsmead boarded a flight on the new Dutch airline, KLM. That flight crashed while taking off in Bangkok. On this occasion, 5 people were killed, and Brinsmead suffered serious injuries from which he never recovered. He died 2 years later. Meanwhile, the surviving passengers carried on to London in a replacement plane. That plane crashed on the return trip. Daly Waters claims to be Australia's oldest international airport, though I suspect many other venerable airstrips make a similar boast. It is certainly true that it was used as a stop-off point on some international flights, and more regularly on cross-country flights from Queensland to Western Australia, so it was a kind of crossroads. The airport stayed open until 1947. The pub opened in 1938, so it is not by any stretch the oldest in the Outback or the Northern Territory, but it is certainly one of the most extraordinary. As with most Outback pubs, every inch of interior surface, walls, rafters, wooden support posts, was covered with mementos left by earlier visitors, college ID cards, driver's licenses, folding money from many nations, bumper stickers, badges from various police and fire departments, even a generous and arresting assortment of underwear, which dangled from rafters or was nailed to walls. The rest was nicely Spartan, a large but basic central bar, concrete floor, bare tin roof, an assortment of tables and chairs of different vintages and styles, a battered pool table. At the bar, seven or eight men, all in shorts, T-shirts, boots, and bush hats, stood drinking stubbies, squat bottles of beer, served in insulated foam holders to keep them cold. They all looked hot and dusty, but then everything in Daly Waters was hot and dusty. The atmosphere in the pub can best be described as convivially sweltering. Even standing still, the sweat dripped off us. The windows had screens, but most were full of holes, and anyway the doors were wide open, so flies came in freely. The men at the bar gave me compact but friendly nods as I bellied up to the bar, and obligingly made space for me to stand to order, but showed no special interest in me as an outsider. Clearly, as the souvenirs attested, visitors were not a novelty. I acquired a pair of chilled stubbies and conveyed them to the table, where Alan sat beneath a bumper sticker commemorating a visit by the Where the Fuck Are We Touring Club. Alan was suffused with a strange happiness. "You like it here," I said. He shook his head with a kind of speechless delight. "I do, I actually do." "But I thought you hated it." "I did," he said. "But then I was sitting here looking out the window at the setting sun, and it was lovely. I mean, really quite astoundingly lovely. And then I turned and saw the bar with all these Outback characters, and I thought, bugger me, I like it here." He looked at me in the frankest wonder. "And I do, I really like it." "I'm so pleased," I said. He drained his beer and rose. "You ready for another?" Now it was my turn to be filled with wonder. I started to point out that it was a touch early to be setting such a blistering pace. But then I thought, what the hell? We had come a long way, and this place was, after all, built for drinking. I drained my bottle and handed it over. "Sure," I said. "Why not?" Well, I can't pretend I remember a great deal of what followed. We drank huge amounts of beer. Huge amounts. We ate steaks the size of catcher's mitts. They may actually have been catcher's mitts, and washed them down with more beer. We made many friends. We circulated as if at a cocktail party. I talked to ranchers and sheep shearers, to nannies and cooks. I met fellow travelers from around the world and talked for some time to the proprietor, one Bruce Caterer, who told me the complicated story of how he had come to own a pub in this lonely and far-flung spot, of which confidence I have not the tiniest recollection, and certainly nothing approximating a note. As the evening wore on, the bar grew almost impossibly crowded and lively. Where all the people were coming from, I couldn't guess. What was certain was that there were at least 50 cheerfully committed drinkers tucked away in the bush in the vicinity of Daly Waters, and at least as many visitors like us. I got comprehensively beaten at pool by at least 14 people. I bought rounds for strangers. I called my wife and professed my lasting devotion. I giggled at any story told me and radiated uncritical affection in all directions. I would have gone anywhere with anyone. I awoke the next morning fully clothed and on top of the bedding, with no clear memory past the catcher's mitt portion of the evening and a head that felt like a train crash. I pressed my watch to an eyeball and groaned at the discovery that it was nearly 10 o'clock. We were hours late if we were ever going to get to Alice Springs. I stumbled down to the bathroom and put myself through some cursory ablutions, then found my way blearily into the pub. Alan sat propped against a wall with his eyes closed, a cup of black coffee steaming untouched before him. There was no one else around.
"Where, coffee, where?"
I croaked in a tiny voice. He indicated vaguely with a weak hand. In a side room I found an urn of hot water and containers of instant coffee, tea bags, powdered milk, and sugar with which to make a hot beverage. I loaded a cup half full with instant coffee powder, dribbled in some water, and rejoined Alan. Weakly, in the manner of an invalid, I lifted the cup and introduced a little coffee to my lips. After a couple of more sips, I began to feel a little better. Alan, on the other hand, looked terminally wretched. "How late were we up?" I asked.
"Late."
"Very late?"
"Very."
"Why are you sitting with your eyes closed?" I asked.
"Because if I open them, I'm afraid I'll bleed to death."
Did I disgrace myself? I peered around the room to see if my boxer shorts were draped from any rafters.
"Not that I recall," he said. "You were shit at pool." I nodded without surprise. I often use alcohol as an artificial check on my pool playing skills. It's a way for me to help strangers gain confidence in their abilities and get in touch with my inner wallet.
"Anything else?" I asked.
"You're doing a house swap next summer with a family from Korea."
I pursed my lips thoughtfully. "North or south?" I asked.
"Not sure."
"You're making this up, aren't you?" He reached over and plucked from my shirt pocket a business card, which he presented to me. It said, "Park Ho Lee, Meat Wholesaler," or something, and gave an address in Busan. Underneath it, in my own handwriting, it said, "June 10th through August 27th, no worries." I placed the card, folded once, in the ashtray. "I think I'd like to get out of here now," I said. He nodded, and with an effort of will rose from the table, wobbled ever so slightly, and went off to gather up his things. I hesitated a long moment and followed. 10 minutes later, we were on our way to Alice Springs. Chapter 16. Now here's a story to ponder. In April 1860, during the second of his heroic attempts to cross Australia from south to north, John McDougall Stewart reached the almost waterless center of the continent, roughly halfway between the present sites of Daly Waters and Alice Springs. 1,000 miles from anywhere, the spot was the very climax of desolation, as Stewart's fellow explorer Ernest Giles once nicely put it, and Stewart and his men went through hell to get there. They were sick and ragged and half-starved, and it had taken months, but at least they had the satisfaction of knowing that they had become the first outsiders to penetrate to the brutal heart of the continent. So you may imagine Stewart's surprise when, in the middle of this baking nowhere, he and his party encountered 3 Aboriginal men who greeted them by making a secret sign of the Freemasons. Stewart didn't say in his journal what the sign was, but it was clear from his amazed description that it was unlikely to have been coincidental. Then a few days later, Stewart and his men found horse tracks following a natural course across the plains. Finally, some distance farther on, the explorers were setting up camp for the night when some people from the Warramunga tribe approached. One of Stewart's party, a young man named W.P. Auld, was sitting with his boots off, rubbing his aching feet, when one of the Warramunga men knelt before him. While Auld watched bemusedly, the man replaced the boots on Auld's feet and carefully but deftly tied the laces for him, then sat back with a big, pleased smile. It was painfully evident to Stewart that he and his men were not, in fact, the first white people to reach the empty center of the country. So who preceded them? No one has ever had the faintest idea. I mention this to make the point that the outback is an odd and unfathomable place. There is something about all that emptiness that exerts a strange hold on people. It is an environment that wants you dead. Yet again and again, in the face of the most staggering privations, for the meagrest of rewards, explorers ventured into it. Sometimes, as Stewart found, they didn't even bother to leave their names. It is almost not possible to exaggerate the punishing nature of Australia's interior. For 19th-century explorers, it wasn't just the inexpressible heat and constant scarcity of water, but 1,000 other miseries.
Stinging ants swarmed over them wherever they rested. Natives sometimes attacked with spears. The landscape was full of thorny bushes and merciless spinifex, whose silicate pricks nearly always grew infected from sweat and dirt. Scurvy was a constant plague. Hygiene was impossible. Pack animals grew frequently crazed or lost the will to go on. Ernest Giles recorded in his memoirs how his horse once grew so delirious after an unsuccessful search for water that when they returned to camp at the end of the day, the animal plunged its nose into a campfire in the deluded hope that it would provide relief. In pity, Giles gave the animal a drink from his own meager supplies, but it died anyway. Even camels could barely cope with the desert conditions. In Beyond Leichhardt, A History of Australian Exploration, Glenn McLaren notes how blowflies doted on the wounds of camels, laying eggs in any raw lesions, which soon erupted in horrible swarms of wriggling maggots. On one expedition, a camel's wound grew so infected that the maggots were scooped out daily with a pint pot. Eventually, the animal just lay down and died. When even camels can't manage a desert, you know you found a tough part of the world. For human and animal alike, nearly every breathing moment was a living hell. And yet, over and over, the explorers returned. Nearly every expedition of the 19th century started off with some ostensible practical purpose: to find a route for a telegraph line, to look for gold, to uncover some zone of hidden promise. But almost without exception, the explorers soon became transfixed by the emptiness. Unable to resist its allure, they just pushed on and on. Perhaps no one suffered privations more willingly and repeatedly, to less effect, than Ernest Giles. In 1874, while traveling with a companion named Alfred Gibson through the barren wastes of Western Australia, Gibson's horse died. Giles gave Gibson his own mount, with instructions to follow their tracks 120 miles back to a place called Fort McKellar to fetch another. Gibson lost his way in the emptiness and was never seen again. The area is now called the Gibson Desert. Left to find his own way back on foot, Giles staggered for days over exhausting sandhills, the last 60 miles with almost no water. It was while in this desperate state, tormented by flies and half-dead with hunger, that he famously spotted a baby wallaby and fell upon it, devouring it raw, fur, skin, and all. These were not exceptional experiences, you understand. This is what awaited you when you went into the outback. When Robert Austin and his men, lost in the featureless wastes of Western Australia, drank their own and their horses' urine, there was nothing terribly unusual about that. Lots of people did likewise in the desert. When Giles found and devoured the baby wallaby, he thought himself exceedingly lucky, not just at that moment, but for years afterward. "The delicious taste of that creature I shall never forget," he wrote with sincere and telling enthusiasm in his memoirs. Stuart and his men retained equally fond memories of a time, on the brink of starvation, they found a clutch of dingo puppies and boiled them up in a pot. They were, he wrote, delicious. Why people repeatedly subjected themselves to such ordeals is a mystery that surpasses understanding. Despite the extreme travails he experienced on the fatal expedition with Gibson, Giles returned almost at once to his compulsive wanderings. Stuart did likewise. Almost continuously for 4 years, he hurled himself at the unyielding interior until he succeeded in breaking through. Worn out by the effort, he retired to London and died soon after. It is impossible to say who endured the greater hardships, Stuart or Giles, but there is no question that Giles did it for less reward. No explorer was ever unluckier. In the same year that he lost Gibson in the desert and stumbled 120 miles through appalling heat, Giles also explored the central regions around the area known as Eulara. One day he struggled up a small rise and was confronted with a sight such as he could never have dreamed of finding. Before him, impossibly imposing, stood the most singular monolith on earth, the great red rock now known as Uluru. Hastening to Adelaide to report the find, he was informed that a man named William Christie Goss had chanced upon it a few days ahead of him, and had already named it Eyre's Rock in honour of the South Australia governor. Eventually, too old to explore, Giles ended up working as a clerk in the goldfields of Coolgardie, where he died in obscurity in 1891. Today, he is almost completely forgotten. No highway bears his name. And so the doughty Mr. Sherwin and I proceeded through the hot and inexhaustible desert. As we proceeded south from Daly Waters, the landscape became more sparsely vegetated. It began to feel eerily as if we had left planet Earth. The soil took on a reddish glow, more Martian than terrestrial, and the sunlight seemed to double in intensity, as if generated by a nearer, larger sun. Even on a smoothly paved highway, in the comfort of air conditioning, you are not entirely robbed of the sense of what the explorers must have gone through. The discomforts can't be fully imagined, but the scale can, and it was awesome. To the left were several thousand square miles of stubbled nothingness called the Barkley Tableland, which eventually merges into the Simpson Desert, probably the toughest ranching country in the world. So unyielding is the land that ranches have to be vast to support a single operation. The largest of them, at a place called Anna Creek, is bigger than Belgium. To the right, unbelievably, the land was even harsher. This was the infamous Tanami Desert, an area of hellish dryness that even now is almost entirely uncharted. On my map, not a feature was indicated, not a dried creek bed or old dirt track, for 300 miles to the Western Australia border. Beyond that, it was virtually as bleak for 600 miles more. Even along the Stuart Highway, with its life-bearing traffic, the 550-odd miles between Daly Waters and Alice Springs could boast just one small town, an old gold mining community called Tennant Creek, three or four clustered habitations that made Daly Waters look cosmopolitan, and a roadhouse perhaps once every 80 miles. And that was it. I had never been out in such a boundless blank. Eventually, some hills began to rise in the middle distance, the McDonnell Ranges. Very occasionally, once or twice an hour, a road train would bomb past. Once, we saw an approaching car, the driver evidently sedated by monotony, leave the road and bang wildly along the rough shoulder for perhaps 200 feet, pulling in his wake a long speed ramp of dust. As he neared us, stirred possibly by Alan's honking, the driver jerked to startled wakefulness and veered reflexively, but much too sharply, for the pavement, and thence, to our shrill amazement, into our path. It was absurd. In an area of inexpressible emptiness, the only two pieces of moving metal were about to bang together in a very big way. There passed an instant made up in equal parts of horn blare, muted shrieks, and wild tight swerves. For the strangest moment, time went into a rest, and I could see perfectly our unwitting assailant, frozen as if in a candid photograph, looking at us with a mixture of bewilderment and apology. I shouldn't wonder that it's a moment all people are given when they are about to die suddenly. Then all was blurred swiftness again. The cars passed without hitting, goodness knows how, and I turned full in the seat to watch our adversary shooting away into the distance behind us, soberly attentive to his lane. I watched until he was a dot at vanishing point, then turned to Alan. "Well, I don't know about you," he said brightly, "but I'm ready for a cup of coffee and a change of underpants." "Excellent plan," I agreed, and I joined him in scanning the horizon for a lonely but welcoming roadhouse.